I next met with Dr. Bill Gradishar, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So the first patient is a 60-year-old woman who came to us because she was in follow-up, and concurrently, she was also being seen by hepatology for completely unrelated issues. And she had been diagnosed at some point earlier with early-stage breast cancer. She was appropriate for anti-hormonal therapy alone, which she was on in the form of anastrozole. And she was going along just fine, absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. And she was seen by hepatology for her other problem, and they decided to get scans to evaluate her liver, which was known to be cirrhotic. And they happened to see something that looked suspicious for a node, which they then followed with a PET scan. And just to emphasize again, this lady had no symptoms. She felt great and had been feeling great for as long as we knew her. So the PET scan lit up, and of course it was read as suspicious in this one particular area, which then led to the predictable need to biopsy it to see what was going on. And as it turned out, it remained ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer with absolutely no other sites of disease. So the dilemma at this point is in this lady who's otherwise doing very well, she now suddenly has what's clearly evidence for minimal but real metastatic disease.
What were the options you thought about? And I guess if you think about it, she does have a single site of met. You could take it out or radiate it.
We've been somewhat hesitant to do that. Of course, there are data that would suggest that if you can get at something that appears to be oligometastatic, that patients may have a generally good prognosis. This was situated in a place that it made it a bit of a bigger consideration if surgery was going to be an option. So that's not the path we went on. I mean, we do view this as metastatic disease. And the typical pattern is, of course, more than a single site. And the odds are with time, this may blossom. But the other issue, of course, is might this have been there right from the get-go?
Sure.
And there would be no rationale for doing scanning on such a patient at the beginning. I didn't describe the details, but she essentially had a stage one hormone-sensitive breast cancer, so there wouldn't be any rationale for scanning.
Did you see her originally?
We did.
And how big was the tumor? And I assume her nodes were negative.
Yeah, she had a node-negative tumor that was roughly about, I think, 1.5 to 1.8 centimeters. So it was a stage one, so this is not somebody that you would have a high index of suspicion for any problems.
Did she have an Oncotype done or a genomic assay?
She did, and it was low.
So that really drove the decision to use hormonal therapy.
Right. So everything fit that this was going to be, you know, sort of a bread and butter, hormone sensitive, relatively indolent breast cancer and was treated accordingly.
I'm going to guess you kept the anastrozole going and decided to follow her and see if it got bigger.
Well, we talked about that as an option. And of course, we don't have the hindsight of being able to know whether or not that was present a year earlier or whatever it was. So we did talk about that. That made the patient a little bit nervous. So we actually talked to her about adding palbociclib to endocrine therapy. And so that was the strategy that we employed.
So you kept the anastrozole going or switched to another agent?
We switched. Part of that is pragmatic, just to make sure we get approved. So we did switch her.
To letrozole or fulvestrant?
She didn't want a shot either. So we went to letrozole.
Was this before or after ASCO?
This was before.
Maybe you can comment on what was presented at ASCO and kind of what you think it meant.
Well, the data with palbociclib is pretty impressive in my view. I think that if you look at the original Paloma-1 study in patients who were more or less receiving therapy as first-line treatment for hormone-sensitive metastatic breast cancer, the addition of palbo to an aromatase inhibitor significantly enhanced the progression-free survival. It was pretty impressive. It almost doubled it. We've now treated dozens and dozens of patients. A lot of them are just starting to come up on their scans where we're getting a sense of whether we are recapitulating what was seen in the study, but I would say it's sort of a mixed bag in terms of has everybody seemingly benefited or not. We don't know yet. The data that was presented at ASCO just a few weeks ago and then concurrently published in the New England Journal of Medicine was a trial that looked at fulvestrant plus palbociclib versus fulvestrant alone. in patients who had gotten prior therapy. And again, we're starting to see the same sort of improvement in outcome that was demonstrated in Paloma 1. And furthermore, again, the same toxicity profile was demonstrated. It was generally very well tolerated. That's been our personal experience as well. Although, of course, you are now following blood counts.
Can you be a little bit more specific? First of all, both in terms of the data as well as your own clinical experience, do you think there's any kind of quality life side effect issue?
What our experience has been is that the patients getting palbociclib don't really notice much of anything. And that's been pretty interesting. I think where the quality of life changes, I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is for the physician. Because rather than giving endocrine therapy C in 3 months, we're saying you're getting palbociclib, you need to get back here in a month. And then on the 2-week mark, we got to check another blood count. So we have to be more vigilant about following people's blood counts.
What exactly has been seen and what have you observed in terms of myelosuppression? Do you see any neutropenic fevers, for example?
We've seen probably 1 or 2. That's not been very common. That's been uncommon. For the most part, most patients have had asymptomatic neutropenia. So we haven't really seen the need to hospitalize anybody. We haven't seen any documented infections in anyone. But there have been a fair number of patients where we've either had to hold or drop their dose a little bit in order to continue. But it's from the patient standpoint, most of our patients, if not all, have said they tolerated fine.
Interesting. And in terms of your clinical application of this, you gave this case as an example. And I would say, too, I was thinking about it, you know, low recurrence score, recurrence after 1 year, if that's what you think's happening. Seems like it would be very unusual. It seems like it'd be more likely that the thing was there all along, although I guess, who knows, maybe someday we're going to be given adjuvant endocrine therapy plus a CDK inhibitor.
Well, those trials, of course, have been proposed. And I think this does raise the issue that we often consider when these new agents become available, including with everolimus, and that is, are we obligated now to use dual therapy for everything? And I think a case can still be made in patients that you could use monotherapy with an endocrine agent. I mean, what the comparisons are not necessarily dictating that this should be done for every single patient. I think there is still a role for monotherapy because there are some extra hoops you have to jump through for these dual therapy strategies in ER-positive disease. So you could make the case, I think, in certain patients that have indolent disease, that they may be better suited to monotherapy rather than these dual therapy treatments.
From a theoretical point of view, and I don't need, maybe there are trials that are looking at this, obviously we're used to sequencing endocrine therapy, multiple agents. These patients often go from one hormonal therapy to another. Does it make sense theoretically to keep the CDK inhibitors going while you switch endocrine therapy?
Well, that's a question that hopefully we'll address. I mean, to some extent, with everolimus, there are trials that are looking at continuing on and switching out the endocrine therapy. We don't know the data from those trials yet, but a similar argument could be made for palbociclib, and it sort of harkens back to the HER2 experience with trastuzumab and the long debate about whether or not it was valid to continue anti-HER2 therapy. Subsequently, of course, we feel that it's important to continue leveraging that. So we may find that using other agents like palbociclib continuously when we have the data may prove a reasonable thing to do. We don't at this point. We stop.
So let's go on and talk about your 65-year-old lady, because I'm kind of curious now that palbo's out there, where that leaves everolimus.
So the second lady, again, is a relatively typical hormone-sensitive breast cancer patient. She's a 65-year-old lady who we saw as a second opinion, having gotten her initial therapy for early-stage breast cancer elsewhere several years before, and was treated with chemotherapy, and I think even had tamoxifen at that time. She was placed on exemestane at the time that her disease progressed, and it was manifested primarily by bone metastases. She stayed on that for roughly 9 months before developing progression of disease. So she had tamoxifen followed by exemestane and now has progressive disease. So this is a situation where we have a number of different options. And I think that the positioning of the two partners for endocrine therapy, meaning everolimus and palbociclib, it becomes a bit of a challenge figuring out where to use them. I think the data with palbociclib certainly positions it reasonably as a first-line therapy. And for patients who progress on palbociclib, it would be certainly a consideration to use a different or alternative endocrine therapy with everolimus. This patient, based on the Paloma trial, she could get palbociclib, or having progressed through an AI, she could go on to everolimus. My own sense is, we'll see what our colleagues do, is that as time goes on, I think that there are more people that are going to be treated with palbociclib up front, and everolimus will sort of get pushed back a little bit. I don't know that that'll be the actual reality, but that's sort of what I'm thinking based on the tolerability of palbociclib versus everolimus. So this particular patient was put on an AI plus everolimus. And we don't know what the result of that maneuver was. We were seeing her as a second opinion. We couldn't say that that was a wrong move, but it's too early to say whether she's benefited from that strategy.
Any problems with the everolimus? Any mucositis?
Well, that's been our experience, that compared to palbociclib, just from a patient tolerability standpoint, we've had a bit more issue with everolimus because patients will manifest things like mouth sores, or they can get some peripheral edema, rarely some pneumonitis. So it's a little bit different in terms of tolerability. And in many cases, we have to go from the 10 to the 5 milligrams in order to continue patients on it. We've seen patients who clearly seem to have benefited from the combination, as was demonstrated in the pivotal trial that led to its approval. But whereas with palbociclib, we now find ourselves checking blood counts, with everolimus, of course, you have to watch for the symptoms that patients are more likely to manifest, such as what you mentioned, stomatitis, et cetera.
Where do things stand, and what are you doing in terms of preventing mucositis? We've been hearing about corticosteroid mouthwashes, for example.
Yeah, we do use that, and I think it does help. We found that when patients develop that, certainly those kind of preparations have seemed to minimize the same sort of symptoms going forward. So we do use that.
Anything else you want to say about either of these patients or this topic?
I would just amplify your notion earlier, and that is that because these agents in a metastatic disease setting seem to enhance the outcome for those patients, these agents are, of course, attractive to consider as components of adjuvant therapy, and they are being evaluated as such in large trials now.
So let's go on and talk about your 42-year-old lady.
So this is a 42-year-old woman that we saw a couple of years ago who presented as a newly diagnosed patient with triple-negative breast cancer involving her right breast. Clinically, it was about 3 centimeters. There were no axillary adenopathy that was appreciated, and the rest of her exam was otherwise pretty much unremarkable. And for this patient, I think that technically she could have gone straight to surgery because of the breast tumor ratio. We did have a clinical trial that was open at the time looking at the combination of eribulin and carboplatin, and she was enrolled on that trial. And how that trial was designed is that patients would get eribulin and carboplatin prior to surgery, and after surgery, you could do what you wanted. So in other words, if you felt in your own mind that it was imperative that a patient received an anthracycline, you are at liberty to do that. So in this particular patient, she got eribulin carboplatin. She received 4 cycles of therapy. Clinically, she not only was doing well throughout the course of therapy at the time of surgery, this particular patient almost had a complete PCR in the breast, and there were no nodes that were involved in the axilla. So she had a very good response. And postoperatively, we did treat her with AC because there wasn't complete resolution of all disease.
So just to clarify, though, she had a mastectomy or lumpectomy?
This lady had a mastectomy.
And did she have a sentinel node biopsy or an axillary dissection or both?
She had a sentinel node that was negative.
So I'm curious if you can talk a little bit. And how did she tolerate the therapy, incidentally?
It was pretty well. I mean, she had, with 4 cycles, she had some drops in her blood counts. She had a little bit of neuropathy, but very little. And most of that resolved once she was done with the chemotherapy, you know, now that we're following her. So it was generally pretty well tolerated, except for mild myelosuppression.
And because I want to ask you about your general approach about neoadjuvant therapy, but before we get into that, can you talk more about the study itself that you was part of, what the rationale was for it, and what you observed?
Well, we thought that in triple-negative breast cancer, again, using microtubule agents and a taxane, microtubule agents obviously in the form of eribulin, and then a platinum, particularly with triple-negative breast cancer, there's some evidence that it may be a class of agents particularly suited to that subset of breast cancer. So we thought that combining them, and there was also preclinical data that supported that combination as effective. So there was some preclinical rationale for putting these two drugs together. And we found in the trial that there was a pretty good overall PCR rate of roughly 40-some percent, which was pretty reasonable compared to other treatment options. We were also hoping, although I don't think that's going to come to fruition, because one of the drugs, Eisai, who develops the drug and markets the drug, also had a PARP inhibitor, and we were hoping that we could build on the experience with eribulin and carboplatin and put a PARP inhibitor into the mix, but I'm not sure that that next trial is going to happen.
Just a couple of words in general about your approach to neoadjuvant therapy. First of all, do you generally, in people who have negative axilla clinically, as this lady did, do an ultrasound or MRI of the axilla?
We generally would. If we're thinking about pre-op therapy and if there was anything suspicious, we would probably biopsy it.
And this lady had, what, ultrasound?
Yes.
So the other question has to do with indication for neoadjuvant therapy. And there's been some debate about this. I was looking at a pro and con debate that Terry Mamonis and Monica Morrow did at the American Society of Breast Surgeons about this. And there are a substantial number of physicians who, particularly in triple negative, as this lady have, or HER2 positive, will give neoadjuvant therapy, for example, 2 centimeters and higher, clinically node negative or node positive. And maybe not necessarily with the ER positive, HER2 negative. We just did a survey. I think you participated in it.
Yeah, I did.
And what we found was, in general, that's what most investigators are doing. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, I would certainly say that's the case with HER2 positive disease and tumors bigger than 2 centimeters or with positive nodes. The validation of that strategy still remains. We have to see what the results of the AFFINITY trial is. But I think the rationale in HER2 positive disease is that it affords you the opportunity to administer pertuzumab, which you may get some pushback on if you try to use it adjuvantly. So being able to give it preoperatively in a HER2 positive patient is probably what's the big motivating factor. And if the AFFINITY trial is not positive, and I hope it is positive, that may call into question this whole pre-op strategy in HER2 positive disease.
Well, actually, I kind of been thinking a lot about this since we did this project. And in fact, we just submitted an abstract from that survey. Because the thing I was thinking about, people always talk about what you just talked about, but there is another issue. And you kind of alluded to it before when you said that she had a sentinel node, which is, even with people with clinically negative axilla, a certain fraction of them are going to have positive sentinel nodes or axillary involvement. And we know that you can downstage a certain fraction of patients, you know, particularly with triple negative and HER2 positive. So even if there isn't an adjuvant benefit, isn't there a known benefit in terms of avoiding axillary node dissection?
Well, there might be. I guess the big issue is going to be by downstaging. If you're talking strictly about the axilla, sure. I think for most patients, it's probably not going to affect their surgical decision about the breast itself. In a small fraction, it will. But it may affect the axilla in some patients. That's true.
I mean, the thing that I didn't really realize until, you know, because we, as part of this survey, we have 59 investigators. Half of them were surgical investigators. And what we saw is that this algorithm that you just talked about post-neoadjuvant sentinel node, that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And if the sentinel node's negative, they don't do an axillary dissection.
Correct.
I'm guessing that's what your surgeons do.
Right.
Anyhow, it's just something I've been thinking about, and I'm not sure I've really sorted it out. You tell me.
No, and the other issue is in the other subsets of breast cancer. I think for triple-negative breast cancer, we still don't have a lot of data, although there's a lot of discussion about everybody who with triple negative should get pre-op therapy. I'm not sure that's true. We certainly don't apply that across all patients. Somebody comes to see me with a 1 centimeter clinically negative axilla, they can go to surgery. I don't see any reason why they have to get pre-op therapy. You know, if they're on a study, fine, but if they're not. And then the other part of that is, should every triple negative patient who's getting pre-op therapy get a platinum? Well, we have some data, but again, we don't have compelling data that the use of a platinum necessarily translates into a huge improvement in overall outcome.
So maybe just to finish this out and go on to another case, another thing related to neoadjuvant therapy that you alluded to was the issue of pertuzumab, and you have the pleasure slash honor being the head of the NCCN Breast Committee, and you all have had some interesting things to say about pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting. We actually found in the survey of the 59 investigators that about half are using adjuvant pertuzumab, either concurrent with chemotherapy or even out to a year. Can you talk about some of the debates that went on within the committee and what you eventually said and how it affects your own practice?
Right. So the debate really centered on the fact that with respect to using it adjuvantly, there was an approval for its use preoperatively within certain criteria, tumors bigger than 2 centimeters, positive nodes. So you had, in a sense, license to use it in that setting. And we recognize that in the adjuvant setting, we're lacking the data that will come with the AFFINITY trial that does look at postoperative pertuzumab-based adjuvant therapy, which we lack right now. It'll be another year or so. But we felt collectively, even though there was a lot of debate and there was not complete uniformity on this recommendation, that if you happen to see a patient postoperatively who magically you could have seen preoperatively and would have been a candidate for pre-op pertuzumab, you should have the same opportunity to receive it postoperatively. And although the language is purposely left a little vague about the duration, et cetera, we did put language in the guidelines that suggests that it would not be an unreasonable consideration to give pertuzumab postoperatively. I think the spirit for most of us was that if you elected to do that, you would be giving it for a similar duration of time as you would have used it preoperatively. And I know that there are instances where patients are getting it for a full year. I suppose if you can get away with it and get it paid for, more power to you, but there might be pushback because, again, there's no data.
So have you done that yourself outside a trial setting in your own practice?
Only in a couple of patients, both of whom were prepared and are paying for it.
They're paying for it.
Yeah.
Interesting. If you could get it paid for without any problem, would you give it more often and would you give it for a year?
Well, I think I would still wait. I mean, we don't know. Really, I think the Marianne trial, our hypotheses or presupposition that something's going to be positive is not infrequently wrong. So I think that until we have the data, I'm not overly eager to go for a full year.
Let's talk about your 40-year-old lady.
So this is a woman who presented to us with a T2 2.8 centimeter hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative tumor. She had a sentinel node that was negative. She did not want chemotherapy, as most patients would not want it if they don't need it. And we thought in this particular setting, despite the patient's younger age, maybe a little bit bigger tumor, that it would be quite reasonable to recommend an oncotype, either to persuade her that chemotherapy was needed or assure her that if it were a low score, that the decision not to get chemotherapy was reasonable. And as it turned out, her oncotype recurrence score was low at 8.
So just kind of curious, what kind of hormonal therapy? Because in addition to connoting, you know, lack of benefit of chemo, it also is correlated with the benefit from endocrine therapy. You've got a 40-year-old premenopausal lady here. What kind of endocrine therapy did you use?
Yeah, so this woman is still menstruating and obviously premenopausal. So it sort of lends itself to the question of tamoxifen or do you ablate her ovaries or suppress her ovaries? And as you know, the data from the SOFT trial and TEXT trial got at that a little bit, and where the impact of performing ovarian suppression ablation was most demonstrated, where there's really compelling evidence that you really impacted on things, were the youngest of young patients, less than the age of 35, those that were going to get chemotherapy. And as such, in this particular patient, we told her those things. And she was willing to just go forward with tamoxifen without ovarian suppression. This is probably the kind of patient, if one looked forward 5 years, she could very well still be menstruating at 45. And she may be a candidate for extended duration of tamoxifen.
So if she had had a couple of positive nodes, would you have thought more about ovarian suppression?
Definitely. So in that particular case, I probably wouldn't have been getting a recurrence score until we have the data. But assuming she got chemo and assuming she was still menstruating, that is exactly the kind of patient where I'd be a little bit more inclined to push harder for ovarian suppression.
And if you did that, would you still use tamoxifen or an AI?
I'd probably use an AI in that setting. Because again, the data with an AI, again, although somewhat younger patients than 40, she's on the younger end, she's higher risk based on nodes, she's going to get chemo. And in the trial, the patients with the AI seem to do the best.
You wrote a review article recently, The Application of Oncotype DX in Early Stage Lymph Node Positive Disease. I thought it was really great. A literature review really got into the whole issue. I'd like you to go through sort of what you put into that paper and what you take out of it. And how much nodal involvement could this lady have had? If she had like a moderate amount of one node, would you have considered an oncotype? And does your approach to node-positive disease change when you see an elderly patient, 70 years old, for example?
So in the first situation where we have a young patient, I think until we have data from some of the big trials looking at node-positive disease, the Xponder trial, et cetera, that the default is still to consider chemotherapy. Now, that said, if we saw somebody who was younger, who had very minimal nodal involvement, maybe even a smaller primary tumor, that would be the type of patient that we would consider doing an oncotype on. Forget studies. I mean, just if we were talking about how you're going to manage this patient in your office. I think when patients start developing a heavier nodal burden, then my level of comfort in going down that path is less, and I would be more inclined to push for chemotherapy. In the older patients, it's somewhat the opposite in a way, because in those patients, they may have, you know, if you pick a 70-year-old patient that has a node or two nodes with or without other comorbid issues, you have to weigh that into the equation as well as their overall expected lifespan. And that's not being age biased. I think we would still treat patients who are in that age group with chemotherapy. But we do sometimes, you know, elect to use anti-hormonal therapy alone. And certainly if somebody like that did get a recurrence score and it was low, I'd have no reservation about deleting the chemotherapy.
So what do we know right now about genomic assays in the node-positive situation, not just with Oncotype, but other assays, Prosigna, for example? And one of the things that I've heard brought up, and it was actually in the St. Galen paper that came out not too long ago, is the question of whether using these assays as well as the clinical, that you can identify people whose risk of recurrence is so low, for example, 5% or less, that they just wouldn't stand to benefit from chemotherapy, even though you can't demonstrate, let's say, a relative risk reduction. Is that something that we're getting close to?
I think we are, because if you look at data from the Austrian breast cancer group, Michael Nant, I think it was last month in the Annals of Oncology, there was a paper looking at PAM50 in a population of patients with node-positive disease. And as you pointed out, you can identify a group of patients where their risk of recurrence is around the 5% range. And it would be very difficult to argue that applying chemotherapy to everybody with that level of risk is really going to impact in a meaningful way when you take into account the side effects that come along with chemotherapy. So I think you can identify a group that has a very low risk, and even with positive nodes, you may be able to avoid. And by positive nodes, we're talking about one or two nodes. When you start getting into three or four nodes, the risk is still too high, and I don't think that data supports the idea of avoiding chemotherapy.
You mentioned that with this lady, isn't a lot of people thinking about maybe what might be coming up in 5 years and whether or not you're going to want to continue therapy. You mentioned she might likely still be menstruating. Do you think that her starting out with a low oncotype would make you more or less inclined to keep going at 5 years? I could see it both ways. One, that low means less risk of recurrence, but on the other hand, greater endocrine sensitivity.
Right. So I don't know that we know what that means exactly. You're absolutely correct. Because if this patient is driven almost entirely by hormone sensitivity, these may be the patients who actually have late recurrences. And certainly with a bigger tumor, I'd be more inclined to be thinking about longer durations of therapy. There are, again, assays that are being developed to look at this question of who are those patients most likely to develop a late recurrence, things like the breast cancer index, oncotype. There have been other assays that are being developed for that purpose. So we may have those tools available going forward to define who are the patients that would benefit from the longest durations of endocrine therapy.
I want to maybe take this opportunity to ask you about a couple of papers from ASCO that relate to this case as well as really all adjuvant cases, which is the issue of bone or bisphosphonates and also RANK ligand inhibitors. And one was the much-awaited intergroup study, the SWOG study, Julie Grelow et al., comparing three different kinds of bisphosphonates, and the other by Mike Nant, the investigator you just mentioned, looking at denosumab in the adjuvant setting. Can you talk about those two papers and what you think that means in terms of practice and in terms of, say, a patient like this?
So the SWOG study, which you correctly point out is long-awaited, I think it was a good study, great effort. At the end of the day, I'm not sure what we do with the results because as this was a three-arm trial with three different bone agents, two of which were oral, one was IV, zoledronic acid, ibandronate, cladrenate. And after thousands of patients were treated, the end result is all the disease-free survival, breast cancer, interval, everything, all those parameters were perfectly superimposable. There was no difference between the treatment arms. If you look at the toxicity, again, for the most part, it looks pretty comparable. And I suppose if you're trying to split hairs, there is a little bit of an uptick, if I recall correctly, in ONJ in the patients who receive zoledronic acid. But we're still talking about like a half percentage point. So I don't want to say the trial was a wash, but it didn't actually tell us necessarily that one is clearly the outlier that's better. There was, I think, a survey of patients who participated in the trial, and predictably patients like taking oral medications more than getting IV medications. And I think Julie made the comment at the end in her concluding slide that this should be a call for us to get more of these oral agents approved in the United States. But in terms of how it's going to affect practice, the treatment arms were completely similar.
Well, you know, I guess I'm wondering, I don't know how many people are using bisphosphonates in the adjuvant setting right now. I mean, outside of people with bone loss or AIs, et cetera, but to try to decrease recurrence. But to me, I found it a little bit negative from that point of view. I was expecting slash hoping that the zoledronic acid would have less recurrences. And actually, like in myeloma, there's a study where they compared zoledronic acid and oral agent, and there was a difference in terms of survival there. Do you think it kind of negates the concept that you can avoid recurrences, or do you think they all do it, but just the same?
Well, we certainly, I think, would have difficulty identifying that impact in this trial design. There are certainly advocates who think, based on the meta-analysis as well as individual trials, that the bisphosphonates, particularly in a postmenopausal estrogen-deprived environment, may have some impact on disease recurrence. But I suspect that that's a debate that will continue, and I don't see any data set coming along that's going to address that and answer the question definitively.